Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What an astonishing cup tie this has been over three quite incredible days. Look at the joy there. And already Ian Allinson, the substitute for Arsenal, is on. Allinson onside. Arsenal. Goff trying to close him down. He's got it! It's 1-1! Yet another Arsenal comeback.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Pleasure to have you here. My name is Marcus Speller. Jonathan Wilson is opposite me. And today we have John Cross, chief football writer for The Mirror and author of Arsene Wenger, an inside story of Arsenal under Wenger. John, pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Today we go back to March 1987, the League Cup semi-final replay between Tottenham and Arsenal, which finished 2-1 to Arsenal. Why have you chosen this game, John?
Well, I must say, I think maybe people sort of, what I found interesting on these podcasts is kind of games that really help formulate someone's love of the game and sort of particularly kind of moment in time, if you like. And I have to say, this was, it's strange as a journalist. I think you sort of kind of, you know, you grow up supporting and absolutely loving football if you're a football journalist. I'm sure everyone does. But then your football supporting life almost ends when you become a journalist. Mm. And because you become a little bit more dispassionate about it and you have to be professional.
Well, it's a job.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
well,
and
there's also the fact if you're doing 120 games a season,
yeah,
going to another game for fun is a little bit less fun than you see
yeah,
when you're doing 20 games a season.
I mean, I still do, but it's just you're not in that same zone, are you? I mean, people often sort of say to me, "Oh, you claim to be an Arsenal fan or this, that, and the other." And well, I don't really, you know. I just kind of it's the job, and sort of, you know, grew up as an Arsenal fan. Not going to sort of hide away from that. But it was this, I have to say, was the greatest night of my football supporting life. It really was. It was just an amazing time. I loved it because I'd sort of watched Arsenal, you know, ever since my dad sort of kind of first took me. My dad was sort of kind of born and brought up, you know, around the corner from the old Highbury, and sort of went as a kid. Remember the sort of the first game I went to, glorious sort of sunny end of season game. I remember going upstairs and seeing the sort of the light shards sort of kind of in that spring sort of, you know, early evening game. And it was just an amazing experience. And then began to go with my mates early in the 80s, where a time when you could sort of kind of still just do a paper round, basically, and it would pay for your football home and away. could go and see a random London game if you couldn't go to get to see your team when they're away from home. It was a very
different time.
Oh, it was the best time of my life. And I'd feel sorry for the kids of today without wanting to sound desperately old, which I obviously do. But basically, you're just never going to get that again with either kind of escalating costs, with a membership, which, you know, by the way, you know, so many people struggle to get tickets. I do. To get to any random Premier League game, let alone being able to go and see any game in kind of London week in, week out. Arsenal were hopeless at the start of the 80s. Absolutely hopeless. And basically, I remember going and seeing, you know, Charlie Nicholas was kind of the terrace idol, obviously, but, you know, rarely turned up, would turn up for Spurs games, to be fair to him. You know, Stuart Robson, without doubt, was Arsenal's best player for a couple of seasons. If he was playing, then there stood a chance. If he didn't, forget it. And then basically George Graham came in 1986 and he was just amazing. He just transformed that club. And I would argue that basically that night, and indeed winning the Littlewoods Cup, was the most transformative period. Forget 1989. I think this was the most important game in that particular era of the football club. So it kind of laid the foundations for George Graham's success. And then basically from there, all of a sudden, you know, you had that time, obviously, when Graham left, and then the kind of 2 or 3 years before Arsene Wenger came in. But it laid that foundations almost. Really, it was that big, I think, that this result for Arsenal. Obviously, it was against their great rivals and nothing else mattered at that time. And it was just one of those nights where I just think, I was there. It was the most amazing experience and wonderful, wonderful night.
Yeah.
And that was a really good Tottenham team. I think it's quite easy from our perspective now to think, oh yeah, Tottenham, they won a couple of cups, but essentially from the early 60s to Pochettino's era, they were this sort of nothing mid-table team. David Pleat's team was a really, really good team. Yeah, they got to the final of the FA Cup. They ended up finishing third in the league, semi-final of this competition. And they played in a very sort of modern, unusual way.
Hoddle and Waddle in there. We'll
yeah,
do
I mean,
that,
Hoddle ended up missing this game with, I think, a stomach muscle injury.
But he played in the because it was a two-legged affair.
It was a two-legged semi-final.
That went to a replay. But we'll
yeah, so
that.
The way that team played, after Inverting the Pyramids came out, I was at, still available.
I knew you. If I got a plug in, you do one. So it's 1-1.
Not your latest work, though, is it?
So I was at an airport. I think it was coming, I think from memory, I was coming back from UEFA Cup final, maybe in 2000. And, oh, I can't remember. But anyway, it was a game that not many of the British press had gone to. And I was waiting for my bags to come round. And David Pleat, who I'd never spoken to before, suddenly emerges and
gallops into the scene.
Starts berating me, going, "Why did you miss out my Tottenham team? You said Everton pioneered five midfield. What about my Tottenham team?" Sorry, David. Let me tell you how we played.
Had he not introduced us? He just went straight in.
Yeah, straight in.
He didn't even say, you know, good
even
evening,
check
everyone.
Who I was. No. He was just like, straight in. And he said, we had our dealers sat deep. So we had the back four. Our dealers sat deep as sort of the playmaker. I think he was talking, I mean, Steve Hodge didn't play in this game, but he did play in the FA Cup final.
Yeah.
So Hodge and Paul Allen, sort of the shuttlers, protecting our dealers. Waddle picked whichever wing he felt the fullback was weaker on. Clive Allen as a centre, I mean, 49 goals that season, Clive Allen, extraordinary record. And then Hoddle is sort of a free number 10 going away, felt like. And Pleat was very sort of disparaging of Hoddle's sort of tactical understanding. It was odd given how Hoddle became as a manager.
Yeah, absolutely.
He said, yeah, we couldn't give Hoddle too many instructions, just, you know, go and find your space and play.
Yeah, it's amazing with David Pleat, because I actually, it's such a strange one, because in our weird world that is sort of being a football journalist, you sort of kind of grew up sort of watching Pleat's teams, and in particular that Spurs team, which I agree with you was, I mean, I actually would argue, almost make a case that they were the best team in the country that season. I know
they're definitely the best
about,
team to watch.
Yes, and everything was funneled towards Clive Allen, wasn't it? That was the beauty of it. That was the amazing thing. And he was astonishing. He was on fire. Obviously scored, you know, the goals in that semi-final. But he's just, it was a fabulous thing. And I've got so much admiration for him. And then in our weird world, you actually get to know them a little bit. And I love talking football with David Pleat. He's one of the most engaging, one of the most knowledgeable, you know, one of the best people that you could speak to as a football journalist.
But he's one of those people who also, you can go to the most obscure game and suddenly, oh, there's David Pleat. He absolutely, his breadth of knowledge and his love of all football is extraordinary.
Do you think he's a bit maybe underrated or whatever? Because he's a slightly eccentric character, I think, sort of people see him as. Because what you're saying suggests that he is a little bit underrated or his managerial career was.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, obviously, you know, he had the issues.
Indeed.
But I don't know. I think that 87 team is respected.
Okay.
I mean, they did finish, I think, 16 points behind Everton that season. So they weren't that close to winning the title. Mm-hmm. I think maybe as a broadcaster, he's underappreciated. But that might be his sort of slightly pedantic, slightly kind of odd manner.
Yeah. But, I loved him researching this, and because I'm so passionate about it, I did do quite a lot of research. I hope I can remember it all. But one of the things that I just didn't know or didn't recall from the time in sort of looking it up was this wonderful little anecdote about after the game.
Yeah.
I mean, I might as well just chuck this in.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
About David Pleat. Yeah. And basically, David Pleat has ended up giving George Graham a lift home after the game.
It's extraordinary, it's just, dramatic finish. And they go and have a cup of tea and a sandwich in his office. I'll give you a lift home, George.
It was so amazing. It was incredible. David Pleat described it as basically Arsenal had stabbed Spurs through the heart.
Yeah.
And then basically, they go and have a sandwich in their sort of the manager's room afterwards. George Graham used to live in Cockfosters. And that was on the way back to David Pleat's home in Luton. So jump in, George, and I'll drop you off on the way back. I mean, it's just amazing.
After tea and sandwiches as well. It's just
can
wonderful.
You imagine that these days? It just doesn't happen, doesn't it? You don't get to know sort of the people. And that was in a sort of a wonderful, wonderful time. And there was sort of, you know, I think still until the noughties sort of thing, you know, managers might consider giving. A journalist. I always remember George Armstrong, the old Arsenal reserve team manager, used to offer me a lift home sort of kind of after reserve games. Can you imagine that now? I mean, it just doesn't happen.
But
the whole climate,
the whole thing was so different back then. Yeah. Because, I mean, you watch those games, the state of the pitches, the fans seem more on top. I mean, you've got the old style stands, of course, and so on. It's not that long ago, the 80s in some respect, but yet, as you say, until probably the noughties, maybe a little bit in the 90s, the whole thing looked so differently and felt so differently.
Yeah.
You know, which is tapping into what you're saying about the ticket prices.
Well, like you say, it's not that long ago. It's 33 years.
I know.
And if in 1987,
bearing
did
in
1954
mind,
seem a long time ago? Yes, it really did.
Yeah, but I suppose I'm thinking of, you know, other games we've done on this podcast, like, you know, the Tel Aviv derby in the 20s and so on. Yeah, it's not longer, but then I suppose you put it like that, it's a fair few
But there
decades.
Is that sort of compression thing of, you know, a game you... I mean, I remember watching a highlight on Sports Night, or the ITV equivalent, whichever, I can't remember, but... And yeah, you're seeing it on YouTube, you get the same sense that the atmosphere being something you just don't get now. That sort of real sort of crackle of...
Yeah, it was raw. It was real hatred. I look at other rivalries sort of up and down the country, and you sort of... The Merseyside derby, and I'm sure Liverpool and Everton fans will dispute that about sort of the friendly derby. I mean, I'm sure it can't be all that nice, but maybe...
Certainly not during the 90 minutes.
You know, and it's just... it was a world away from that, and it was really nasty. I remember sort of being walked back by the police with my mates, basically all the way back to Seven Sisters, and felt like I was going to be ambushed at any moment. It wasn't the nicest atmosphere, and that, you know, I remember one guy in particular, this old guy, being pulled out and sort of kind of being set upon by a group of Spurs fans. It was nasty. It was raw. It was brutal. And I guess that all adds to it, to be honest with you. It really does, you know. I mean, it was interesting, wasn't it? I was watching the Manchester game last week, it was, and about that sort of that semi-final. And in commentary, they were sort of saying about no team has lost the first leg at home and then gone on to overturn that first leg deficit and still gone on to reach Wembley. It's not happened since 87. They didn't obviously detail the game in which it was, and it was this one. And so it just shows you the scale of that achievement. It's not been done, you know, sort of kind of, you know, since then. And I guess that's testament to the kind of the never say die attitude and everything that went with it in that game.
Which you see even in the in the first two legs. I mean, even to get it to a replay from where they were at half-time in the second leg wasn't just... So like the first leg... Mm-hmm. At Highbury, Clive Allen.
It was a one-sided game. Arsenal basically started that season really well under George Graham, and basically you know, he got them. I see certain similarities with Mikel Arteta, actually, in that basic former player gets them to play a different way, pressing of its sort in the time, and they really did. They incredibly efficient. Actually, if you look at the two games at White Hart Lane, Arsenal were much better in both of those games because they worked that much harder. They hunted in packs and they defended well. And they didn't do that in the first game. They were comprehensively outplayed. Frankly, Spurs could have killed that game off, the tie off in that first game. Arsenal didn't play well. And basically, you know, I was thinking, that's it really. Because they'd run out of steam a little bit from that early start of the season. You think this season's going to fade away. Mm-hmm. But actually, George Graham had done really well, given the team a bit of hope, given the fans a bit of hope. And then you thought, they're big underdogs. And then basically, as you were alluding to, you know, Spurs score in the first half of the second leg is live on TV on the Sunday afternoon. I remember being there in the stadium and you thinking, oh, this is just kind of slipping away. I just hope I can actually remember thinking, I hope it just doesn't turn into an embarrassment now, because it was 2-0. It was 1.5 games down. It was slipping away. And at that wonderful moment, you know, you now get the infamous kind of recollection of the halftime announcement with the ticket details. Brilliant. I mean, it was just a moment in time.
Well, so you're absolutely right. It was so sort of one-sided, as you say, that at halftime, the announcer to Spurs fans the ticket information for the final.
Yeah, it was incredible. Aussie's gone to Wembley.
The confidence, I mean, it's a bit, it's akin to Ajax playing Spurs in that semi-final of the Champions League. Half time when they're playing the Bob Marley song, which I know they play regularly, but everyone thought, oh, well, we're on. Yes. We can enjoy this second half now.
Yeah, absolutely. Funny enough, I was in Amsterdam. Oh, right. And it was just, you never thought that was going to end in anything but an Ajax
victory.
And it was exactly the same like that. And actually, David Pleat also details it, you know, about how the Spurs directors had sort of kind of printed these T-shirts.
After the first leg, they're talking about printing T-shirts for the final.
Astonishing, absolutely astonishing. Can you imagine?
It's amazing how often the teams do this. It's incredible hubris. So,
learned from Brazil in the 1950 World Cup, Jonathan?
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's a great example. Yeah. On the morning of the final game, printing the headline, Brazil Campeones. Which the Uruguay team then kind of, they buy every newspaper from the hotel lobby and they go up to one of their rooms and put them on the floor and piss on them.
Yeah.
obviously, Werder Bremen, when they lost the Bundesliga on the final day to Bayern Munich, and as they went out for the second half of the game, there's loads of bottles of champagne lined up.
Oh my goodness.
And then they come back in 45 minutes later and just walk past this unopened champagne. Be really careful about that kind of stuff, because
it's
such a nonsense. But there was a crucial miss in that first half of the second leg. Clive Allen, the ball comes over to him. And maybe a full stretch or whatever, but you'd have probably fancied him to score, and he misses.
Yeah.
And you'd think to yourself, that probably would have killed the tie if it wasn't already dead.
Yeah.
And it's those little ones, you know, as you say, you get overconfident, you miss a good chance and so on. George Graham would have got them in at half-time and thought, we're still in this.
Absolutely he would have. And he was a great motivator. Mm. And as I say, he did get them. I mean, they were brilliant in that second half. Suddenly they up the ante. And I think you could see the anger coming in their performance, because they were suddenly closing down. There was a sort of a moment which actually I think the you tape everything and watch it when you get home at that stage. And I remember re-watching it back, and the analysts sort of kind of pointing towards how Arsenal sort of closing down in that second half, and they were working their socks off, not a moment's, you know, sort of peace for the Spurs players. And suddenly they got a grip of that Spurs midfield, the five-man midfield, for the first time in the tie. And suddenly it began to change. And I do actually think it probably came from that George Graham motivational halftime talk, spurred on by this incredible sort of halftime announcement, which, I mean, David Pleat sort of still sort of says, oh, I'm not sure they could have heard it in the dressing room, whether they heard it or not. It's sort of kind of in the tunnel, or Perry Groves details. He was out of this game injured, but basically coming down from the stands and sort of telling the dressing room about it. You'll never guess what I've heard. And basically telling the players, and they were spurred on by this. And George Graham sort of delights in always proving everyone wrong. He loved doing that in sort of kind of 89, and again in 91. He sort of, you know, would make a thing of kind of pinning up press clippings on the dressing room wall, and he was sort of seized on this moment. And you could see, I think, that spirit of defiance and anger in Arsenal's second half performance in that second leg. They were suddenly a different team. They were going at it and suddenly retrieved that game from absolutely nowhere, and then to pull it back and then take it, you know, to equal and level was really quite something.
Yeah, it was. When,
so, I mean, George Graham, I think, is a perhaps, we talk about David Pleat being an underrated figure. Mm. I wonder if George Graham is slightly underrated, because the reputation he has has been this sort of very, the back four is a thing that everybody talks about. Ruthless offside trap, very pragmatic. Mm-hmm. But I think that probably undersells him slightly, because
slightly tainted.
One of the things that always fascinated me about him is that, you know, as a player, he was, you know, the stroller, kind of a very sort of languid midfielder. How do you go from that to this, you know, incredibly well-drilled offside trap, this rigorous organisation? Mm. The sort of football he as a player would not have dealt well with at all.
Mm.
And it seems to me that it is this time working with Venables at QPR. He was Venables' assistant.
Mm.
And Venables, you think of Venables and George Graham as being quite different football, that Venables is very, you know, in the total football tradition. Learned the game playing for Tottenham in the 60s, becomes Barcelona manager. You know, he's all about that pass and move possession football. But actually, the thing they've got in common is the offside trap. And I think it's easy when we talk about total football to forget that it's predicated on a ruthless offside trap and pushing very high. And it seems that George Graham picked that up from Venables and realised sort of what the application of that could be with a bit slightly more direct approach in the possession approach of Venables. So he is in a very modern tradition, although we think of him now as being sort of quite an old-fashioned English style or British style manager.
Yeah.
He actually had that sort of, you know, he'd learned the Venables sophistication, and he sort of reapplied that in a more British way.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And it's an interesting one, because I remember at the time, I mean, sort of the previous manager, sort of Don Howe, was sort of ousted, and all of a sudden there was talk of Arsenal going for Venables.
Mm.
And then suddenly
it
felt like a bit, when George Graham came in, he was almost the consolation prize.
And he'd been at Millwall between.
Absolutely. And just to put it in context, I mean, he's a former player managing a lower division than at Millwall. How do you compare that? So Campbell? I don't know, maybe that's slightly deriding what George did at Millwall, because, you know, he'd got them drilled, he'd got them on the up, and he'd done a very, very good job at Millwall. But equally, it wasn't a universally popular appointment. And I don't know quite how we judge these things, but because I was quite enthused at the time, I was still at school, and I was thinking, blimey, I'm quite up for this, because basically former player will make a difference and he'll work them hard. And it was quite different. And he was, the other thing about this was not only a languid player, but known equally as gorgeous George, wasn't he? Because he liked a night out, basically. And he just wasn't what you think as a disciplinarian manager. And he just came in and he ruthlessly took apart kind of so many players who had just been sort of ambling along. Arsenal had become a retirement home for the likes of, you know, so, I don't know, Woodcock, Mariner, that sort of thing, really. And he basically wanted hungrier players. And he kind of built together a sort of, you know, the players coming through like Rocastle, like Michael Thomas, and gelled them together in the first instance, anyway, with players like Viv Anderson, Kenny Sansom. And it just worked and it clicked, and he got them working, and he got them, you know, fighting hard and showing some real pride in the shirt. And that was it was typified by this comeback and this incredible game. But it was a shame for George in the way that it obviously ended in sort of scandal and disgrace. And I've always felt that he deserved a bit more respect and credit. And I'm so pleased in recent times, quietly and slowly but surely, he's kind of been welcomed back by the modern Arsenal, if you like. And so he's welcomed back on the pitch in games and stuff in the last two or three seasons, which is something, you know, which hasn't happened before. It really hasn't, because of obviously the manner of his departure.
Mm.
And for, you know, a fan of a certain generation, someone like, you know, my age, it's brilliant to see, because he deserves a bit more respect for the scale of the achievement. Because Arsenal were completely, you know, they were drifting. They were the mediocre. They were a nothing team, basically, and they were sort of kind of threatening. They hadn't won anything since what was it?
79.
79, yeah, difficult.
And you know, that was just fleetingly as well, you know. And it was just the way he put them back on the map was something really quite special.
Yeah. All right, let's have a quick break, and after which we'll talk about the game itself. See you in a moment.
Deep, deep one. Quinn hoping to get on the end of it. It comes to Allinson, driven first time in.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Right, gentlemen, let's get down to it then. So, of course, the two legs had ended 1-0 to Spurs at Highbury, and then Arsenal had beaten Spurs 2-1 at White Hart Lane. Spurs won the cost of a toin. Toss of a coin is the expression I'm trying to say. And they obviously chose to play at White Hart Lane. Why wouldn't they? And so the replay was played at White Hart Lane. But as you said, John, in the first half, Arsenal raised their game playing at White Hart Lane. And obviously, with hindsight, we can say it was probably good for them that they were playing there. But it fed into that... that siege mentality, perhaps, that George Graham had fostered there, that they'd got themselves back. They won at White Hart Lane. They knew they could win there. And actually, it was almost like the shackles were off a little bit more. They were. It was more level pegging when they went into that game.
Yeah, the away end, which I was in, was basically went crazy about that toss of the coin. Because basically, at that stage, just Arsenal, I don't know why, it had some success at White Hart Lane, but suddenly felt as if, actually... this is swung our way, basically. This is kind of... it was a really strange one in that basically it later sort of almost... well, it did become a song in that basic 1-0 down, 2-1 up. That's how Arsenal won the cup. And it was you know, there's basically also... they sort of revelled in that. There's a series of games that they won 2-1 at White Hart Lane against Spurs. And it was just the way it sort of unfolded. And there was no fear suddenly then. I think also... when they come back, it was such an incredible comeback. How on earth did they do that? And so basically, all of a sudden, they're thinking, well, we've got nothing to lose now. So basically, we're out this cup. We're out the semi-final. We've lost. And suddenly, we're back in it. And so why on earth should we be worried about this? The other remarkable thing is that basically, that game finished on the Sunday. And then, what, 3 days later, on the Wednesday, Can you imagine this happening now?
Well,
it was restaged, so a replay was suddenly rearranged at White Hart Lane.
Because there was no penalties after the two legs and there was no away goals.
Absolutely, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, Arsenal would have gone through, obviously. Yeah. You know. But it was...
Well, you'd have missed out on this game.
Absolutely. And it was suddenly, it was rearranged for the Wednesday. And actually, I was kind of, I don't know, must have been doing something on social media and saying...
People just doing less those days.
Well, it was just weird because it was so strange how suddenly the police sort of kind of, you know, sort of agreed to this. And how did they sort of sort out the tickets? How did they get it doing? Yeah. I mean, back in those days, it was still in the era when you basically bought your programme. And on the back of it, you had one of those tokens, basically.
The voucher to
get your cup final tickets, to get your sort of kind of places. Now, I'd religiously bought programmes. I still collect programmes, actually. And that entitled you. And I cannot remember, but I must have done. We're basically going to go and get a sort of a replay ticket, because apparently it was all ticket. I don't remember that. I remember just going and getting in, you know, and getting in with my pals, basically. It was... You know, just 3 days later, and here we go again. And it was a night match. There was something special, and I still think White Hart Lane is an amazing stadium to go and watch a night match under the lights.
We're so close to the pitch. Yeah.
And I love that. I mean, I do think that the new stadium is incredible, without doubt. But there's something. There was something magical about the away ground in there. Basically, so close, so on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a few times sort of. The away end and sort of kind of you could sit up above and you sort of so on top of the pitch you could almost sort of it almost felt like staring down vertically.
You could jump down onto it.
Yeah, and it was incredible, you know, but it was an amazing stadium, incredible atmosphere, and the sense of anticipation that night was remarkable.
Well, as you say, the atmosphere so shifted so much with those Arsenal fans, but with the players as well. I mean, I've only watched highlights of the game, of course. For my money, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, in this game, Arsenal begin the game, like I say, more on the front foot.
Yeah.
You know, O'Leary has a chance where he sort of flashes wide, but Arsenal, maybe more up for it, but there's the belief, essentially.
Well, it's a really good Niall Quinn chance as well when he shakes off Mabbott and puts it just wide.
Yes.
Oh, no, I think it was Quinn, sorry, I'm not thinking.
Right.
Not
O'Leary. One Irishman, which sounds like they won't mind that.
Forgive me, everybody.
Good luck.
They
did start well, Arsenal. Yeah. Arsenal were definitely on the front foot, and as we referred to before, with Hoddle being out,
so Nico Klassen came in. And Nico Klassen had looked an amazing player in the World Cup in 86. In that Belgian team that got to the semi-final. It never quite happened for him at Spot Tottenham, did it?
No. He was very... I mean, there were flashes there, and basically a very quick player, very aggressive player. But he didn't really fit in. They weren't quite as fluid, and they weren't quite as fluent, Spurs. But I have to say, they came on sort of strong, and once Arsenal didn't go ahead. And it was just one of those games where Arsenal played quite and started quite well. Actually, you're thinking as the game wore on, I remember thinking, how are they going to score? You know, where they're going to score from?
Mm.
And they just kind of couldn't quite create that chance. And then, you know, to go behind, then again, obviously it was Clive.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Well, who I think it's fair to say probably shouldn't have been on the pitch at that point, because he puts a reducer in. Was it, I forget who it was now. Was it Davis, maybe? Paul Davis, that is... Just GBH. Like nowadays,
What do you mean? It's fine. It was absolutely fine in those days. Absolutely fine. No problem.
Not everything was better back then.
No.
Yeah. But I mean, it would have been at least a straight red and three match ban.
Yeah,
it was a shocker.
I think these things were very inconsistent in those days. I mean...
Well, he seems annoyed that a foul's been given.
The Arsenal Leeds FA Cup game.
Yeah.
I was watching a YouTube clip.
Well, this season, do you mean?
Yeah, this season. I was watching a clip of a game from, I guess it must have been... early 70s.
Yeah.
And Gary Sprake just punches somebody. I think by my punch, I can't remember who it is, but just punches somebody who goes down, absolutely lamps him on the jaw. Oh, that's a booking.
Yeah, I know. It's absolutely.
I thought you were going to say the referee gets them together, makes them shake hands. It's good, lads. Yeah. Good lads, get on with it.
But it's sort of, you know, the threshold for what constitutes a sending off was incredibly variable according to circumstances and referee.
Yes.
I mean, I think they started to standardise it a bit by the 80s, but when games aren't televised, it's really hard, I think, or when they're not universally televised, it's really hard to set what an actual standard is. Yeah, you know, we complain about inconsistency now. Way worse then, because you had nothing to compare it to.
No, you're absolutely right. But when Alan puts that challenge in, I think is it Richard Gough also runs up and they start shouting. Now, I'm sure they're saying, because I think someone had maybe stuck one on Alan earlier and so on. But still, like, it doesn't justify that. I mean, he was lucky to get a booking, I'd say, even back in those days.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, if you
think of what Kevin Moran had been sent off for in the 85 FA Cup final, this was much, much worse than that.
Absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, they did have some tough players. I mean, our Arsenal did, by the way, as well. But Mitchell Thomas in that era, absolutely unforgiving sort of kind of, you know, sort of left back, really. But then Arsenal, I don't really think, were able to sort of match them in many ways. Obviously, you sort of kind of had Adams O'Leary and that sort of thing. But they were sort of, you know, not really... particularly a physical team, but they worked incredibly hard. I think, you know, the work rate was...
Well, you think Samson and Anderson down the flight.
Viv Anderson, I think, you know, during the course of these, you know, particularly the two games at White Lane, was worked so hard and
got a crucial goal.
Absolutely.
I think he's a very underrated figure, you know, Viv Anderson. I mean, I know he obviously has the status of being the first black player to play for England. Mm-hmm. And I think that... And clearly that is an achievement that should be celebrated,
but it kind of
sort of detracts from what a great footballer he was. He's brilliant in the Forest team that won in the late 70s. He was a really, really good attacking fullback before attacking fullbacks were all over the place.
Yeah, he was great in that sort of early George era, and then basically forced his way out to join Man United and quickly joined Frank Stapleton as hugely unpopular figures, and you know, was never forgiven as such, despite sort of heroics in this game. And it's really strange, actually, because I think sort of kind of Kenny Sansom had a bit of a sort of unhappy departure, really, in the way that sort of he left. And you put all these, you know, players together, and this Arsenal team, you know, had so many kind of cult heroes of that time. David Rowcastle, I'm sure we'll come on to, you know, Mickey Thomas and Paul Davis then.
Perry Groves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he was injured for this game.
Absolutely ridiculous. And we were talking about this before we came on air, me and Jonathan. I mean, it was just astonishing how, I think Perry Groves was signed from Colchester for £55,000. Ian Allinson, you know, also arrived from there for sort of ridiculously low fee. And these sort of players, you just couldn't... They're never going to get a chance at the modern club.
No. But that status of player who, I mean, I don't know what these players, what their reputation was when they were signed, but definitely is a category of player who'd be signed for something like £55,000 from Colchester. Yeah. And the thought process would be, he can play in three or four positions. Mm-hmm. He's always going to be a 6 or 7 out of 10 player. You know, it's useful to have him in the squad, because if we get injuries, we haven't got a 25-man squad, we've got a 16-man squad, and he's a useful figure to just slot in wherever we need. And they've just disappeared from, I mean, understandably, have disappeared from the modern game. But what it means is you don't get people like Ian Allinson suddenly having their moment in the sun, their 10 minutes of utter glory.
Yeah.
And that is a shame.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, going back to the game itself, so Spurs, it's a 0-0 at half-time.
Yep.
And as you say, Arsenal, you're wondering, how are they going to score? Well, Spurs do score with Clive Allen, as we mentioned.
A very classic 80s goal. An Ardiles free kick from a right, just inside the Arsenal half. Deep free kick from Ardiles. Richard Gough. What a figure of a man.
He used to live down my road, you
did
know?
He? Perfect little flick of a mullet as well.
The iron-ready presence of Richard Gough.
Heads it down. Clive Allen running on, half volleys it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what free kicks used to be.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a punch in the gut, surely, for Arsenal.
Yeah. And actually, I think there was...
And it was on 62 minutes, so there wasn't that much of the game to be played.
There wasn't really. And I do think that at that point, you're thinking, oh, it's slipping away here.
Yeah.
Simply because of the time aspect. And also, Arsenal just weren't creating chances.
And then Charlie Nicholas goes off injured.
Yeah, and
which is why Anson comes on.
Yeah, and I have to say, at that point, you're probably thinking, because Charlie Nicholas was a weird one, actually, because everyone, every Arsenal fan loved him. And, you know, half the North Bank used to have sort of ridiculous wedge haircuts with the curly bit at the end and then basically in tribute to Charlie Nicholas. But actually, when you evaluate, it always makes me laugh to see Charlie Nicholas lecturing the modern day Arsenal player on how
he loves
should,
it, doesn't he?
Yeah, and how you should behave and how you should do things. Well, actually, Charlie, blimey, I wish you'd actually taken that advice on board yourself when, rather than going out nightclubbing every night and only turning up twice a season, which was generally against Spurs. Because actually did have this phenomenal record, but he didn't really turn up in these games, you know, to be honest. So it wasn't the end of the world when he went off. And you're suddenly thinking, actually, they might get someone on with who might go and chase the game down, might go and chase the ball. And sure enough, Ian Anderson was a very willing sort of player like that.
So, Anderson was a left winger, wasn't he? So did Martin Hayes move in the middle, or how did that...
No, Ian Anderson could move... Martin Hayes actually had that amazing season when he could play through the middle and basically was always a right winger sort of through the age groups, and then basically actually had an amazing season where he'd score week in, week out, and then was really quite prolific. And you're thinking that, you know, this, and then basically both of them could then you know, play through the middle as well. But as I recall, Hayes moved up front, and then sort of Allinson then came
in on the left,
from the left. And indeed, if you look at that goal and the way it's sort of
shaped, both the goals come from him sort of cutting in from the left side, don't they?
Yeah, and it's it was an amazing, amazing moment. Ian Allinson was a real kind of, you know, and this goal sort of both really sort of kind of typified his sort of kind of determination. He was kind of, you know, no airs and graces, not particularly sort of kind of, you know, flair player or skills or anything, but very hard working and would chase balls down, really. And so, you know...
Well, he never gave up on that one,
no,
did he?
No, absolutely.
And he sort of spun round. There was a bit of improvisation.
So it's 8 minutes from time. It's a long ball over top from Paul Davis. Yep. He runs onto it. It looks like Richard Gough sort of has shepherded him away from goal.
Positionally, he's there.
But he sort of manages to get his back into Gough and turns. And as he sort of falls, hooks a shot that goes through Gough's legs.
Takes everyone by surprise, really.
Yeah, and just sneaks in at the near post.
Yeah, sneaks in at the near post. And I must say, Ray Clements, we shouldn't forget, really, he was still... He'd been brilliant for Spurs that season. Was obviously a legendary goalkeeper and... And basically, he'd been really good, obviously, magnificent servant for Liverpool. Everyone thinking maybe he's winding down his career. And then basically goes to Spurs and has a new lease of life. And I have to say, this game in particular probably signals the end of greatness
way. Yes.
Look, when you see that ball creep in, and it does creep in, you're thinking, blimey, he's got to get that.
But at the same time... I understand why he was that far across it. I understand why he'd left that gap there, because Gough appeared to be blocking it. And if that ball hasn't gone, if there's an inch either side, where it would have hit Gough's foot.
Mm.
And so I can understand why Clem's thinking about, I've got to protect the far side of the goal.
Yeah,
I know what you mean, because then in the cup final, the Mabbott own goal, he looks really leaden footed.
Yeah.
So he obviously is coming to an end. So I don't know. I'm more forgiving about this, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what about the winning goal?
Yeah,
because that came not that long after.
And again, it's Allinson down the left.
It's a really strange one, because before doing this, I sort of then watched a few sort of bits on YouTube where basically you can see extended highlights just to refresh the memory. And after that goal what goes in to make it 1-1, there's a real sort of kind of almost a bit of a weird lull.
Yeah.
And then it's basically you're thinking... Are both teams a little bit nervous?
Yeah.
You know, kind of, do they...
Yeah. Take thinking, the extra time. And
much football has been played. They're still at loggerheads in that position, the third game in, late in the day in that game.
Yeah, and
Spurs, I know what you mean.
Spurs then have this sort of kind of charge up field. Mm. Arsenal have a bit of a half chance. And you're thinking, I think they're both sort of kind of, they're both seeing it out.
Yeah.
And maybe if one gets a bit of a half, you know, a bit of a chance...
Who blinks first?
They'll take it.
Yeah.
But this is going to extra time, isn't it? I'd resigned myself, you know, to sort of thinking that. And then you suddenly sit, you know, suddenly Arsenal come alive again. Mm. You know, it was a strange one. Ian Allinson, obviously, central to it.
So his cross hits Danny Thomas, who, I have to say, is a player I'd totally forgotten about. But, you know, He got a knee injury. He's not, I think a couple of weeks after this game, never played again.
Yeah, it was Dan McGuire, wasn't it? And it's basically, he was a brilliant player, Danny Thomas.
Yeah, really he got two caps on that team, Australia in 83, when a lot of younger players were tried out.
Yeah, he was excellent. He was sort of full of energy, full of running and so on. And yeah, the
cross
ball
comes
was blocked.
To Rocastle, who first touch so takes him in the box, and then just great composure to keep picking his way through, and then puts it past.
And it sort of, does it sneak under?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. If you questioned Clements for the first one, then
I mean, actually, we shouldn't forget. Michael Thomas missed a really good chance just before this.
Yes, he had. Yeah,
but I mean,
when's
Michael Thomas ever going to score a vital goal?
Oh, he loses it, doesn't he? He loses it. Not a man for the big occasion. Not a man for sort of the score of a big goal under a huge amount of pressure. I'm nothing like that. But it's just, I mean, it was an amazing thing. And David Rocastle was just an absolute God to the Arsenal fans because he was just. I still don't think there's been a player since or kind of before him where he's so skillful, so, you know, brilliantly committed, would go in fearlessly tackle, you know, into tackles and work so hard, you know. And I always thought he, you know, started on the right, obviously, and then basically I thought he would move inside and become a central midfield player. But, you know, he just had so much ability, worked so hard for the team. Every time that you turned up to watch Arsenal, every Arsenal fan would know that they would get everything out of David Rocastle, always smiling, always come across as someone who was so nice and such a great figure. And basically, if there was one player that basically thought, I want him to be the hero, it was Rocky. Everyone loved him, you know, and from the moment he got into the team. And it was just a wonderful moment. The ball breaks to him. That luck, you know, as you referred to, that sort of kind of, that control, that first touch. And then the low shot. And it just, and it creeps in. It was a moment of great intensity and great drama and also great pressure.
Well, it's the perfect type of goal where suddenly the chance is there and you've got that. I mean, even if it's half a second of anticipation, that is the best moment as the fan. That sort of half second where my God, this is a chance for it all to be over. And then it is, and that release.
Yeah.
And I would imagine looking at the way that end sort of goes flailing. Half people probably didn't even see it go in. As soon as it goes past Clements, everybody's just jumping on top of each other.
Well, it was weird because that away end, depending on where you're stood, you basically, the vast majority of the away end can only see actually probably the 6-yard box onwards. So you can't actually see the goal line because it was steep, but also you're right on top of it. And unless you are right at the front, there's sort of a whole section of fans where actually you're looking over and you're sort of peering over, standing awkwardly, desperately trying to see. You've got no chance to see whether it actually hits the net or not.
Half my fondest memories of going to Sunderland as a fan, I didn't actually see the goals.
No, it's really weird.
So Gary Bennett's volley against Manchester United in 1992. Didn't see it or saw much of a day that night.
it's crazy, isn't it? I remember seeing, you know, Rocastle closing in on the thing and he's hit it and then the whole away end erupts and that's when you know he scored. Yeah. I mean, you don't actually see the ball hit the net. And it was just an incredible moment. And it brought together that team. It brought together that sort of kind of that moment and everything sort of, you know, came forward from that moment, really.
Mm. And of course, after that, tea and sandwiches, lifts home, and Arsenal were in the final when they beat Liverpool 2-1. It was the first time Arsenal won the League Cup.
And the first time Liverpool had lost after Ian Rush scored.
Yes. that was the thing.
The curse was broken.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a strange thing, that, because I do actually remember, you know when you go into games these days and basically you hear this weird stat about...
Well, they haven't beaten him for 39 years on a Thursday.
I'm being funny, but if you're Payne fan, if you're a sort of match going fan, you just don't listen to that, really.
Yeah.
You know, kind of all the previews and stuff. But on this occasion,
everybody knew that stuff.
Everybody knew that stuff. Yeah. Everyone was talking about it. And I remember being there, you know, getting to Wembley so ridiculously early to get a good spot and being with all my mates from school and basically watching it. And then suddenly, Ian Rush, and we're And we literally all said, oh, God.
Yeah.
We're not going to win now.
Yeah. But then
and
Charlie Nicholas did turn up.
Absolutely.
The Cannonball Kid had the last laugh.
Absolutely. I don't know quite how it rolled in, but it sort of certainly did. And it was just, yeah, it was just, it was an amazing season. Mm. And that brought together absolutely everything. Yeah. But I think that that night, that game, you know,
laid the foundations.
Just laid everything for Arsenal and indeed the modern Arsenal.
Indeed. John, it's been an absolute pleasure talking
to you.
Oh,
thank you. No, thank it's been a pleasure much. Recalling it.
For more stories like this, of course, do check out theblizzard.co.uk. We'll be back next week. Jonathan, a pleasure as always.
Cheers. Thank
you. Last one, everybody. See you then.
Amazing record of Arsenal. They are through to Wembley. One of the great Women's Cup comebacks. Those two late, late goals. One by Ian Allinson, and then the winner from David Rowcastle.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.